Dr. Feelgood, sleeping on a concrete bench. Can I get a witness? Miss South Carolina, 1975. Somebody stole your crown. Your life had come and gone. Now you're mystified, standing with the best of us, who used to rule the world. Brother Lovejoy, wrapping up a blue streak. Can I get a witness? A Miss Hurricane, can't keep your hands still long enough to count your change. Grind. The cost of living, it didn't even cross your mind. Now you're mystified, standing with the rest of us, who used to rule the world.
Some singers' voices only seem to get better with time, and that's definitely the case with Bonnie Raitt, whose last album, Slipstream, got nothing but raves and earned her another Grammy. That's her 10th. What made it extra special is that she put it out on her own label, and it was her biggest release in over 20 years. Now she's packaged it with her first career-spanning retrospective in a two-disc set called Now and Then. She joined us in November to talk about her latest projects, and because it was one of my favorite interviews of the year, we're re-airing it for you today. I began by asking her, was it scary to start your own label?
No, because I've been in the business since 1970, and I've watched the foibles of, you know, executives coming in for 2 years, and you make alliances with different people in the company, and the music business over the years has had such turnover and implosion that we did a lot of research. I got a great team of women that are in my management office and great distribution, so it's easier to do these days, so it wasn't as scary.
Capitol Records, when you left, wasn't the same as when you arrived.
Right.
Now, your contract ran out in 2005. I'm assuming that after all those multi-million record sales, you had plenty of other offers.
Yeah, I mean, the business had changed. There's different consolidations. There's good, remarkable offers coming, partnering with artists now. But we really had the information, and if you have the stomach to do it and you do the research and you have the team, you can do it on your own. It's economically more feasible.
Well, because of the Internet. In the old days, it was kind of foolhardy to start your own label. People did, but you really needed the power of the big labels because they got distribution.
Exactly, and distribution digitally is, so much easier, and the cost of manufacturing is cheaper.
Where did the title Slipstream come from?
I did it precisely so that when I had interviews and someone said, what's new about this record, I would be able to have a jumping off point that I'm really in the slipstream of all these styles that I love, whether it's rock or blues or R&B or reggae or Celtic or all the different flavors of things that I love. It's not that different from my early records. So I'm in the slipstream and proud to be, and I think I'm hopefully leaving one behind me.
You decided to work with the Grammy-winning producer Joe Henry on the album with his musicians?
Yeah, for four of the tracks we did. I knew I was going to do most of the record with producing it myself with my longtime band, but I wanted to add a little different texture, and I already had a couple of Joe Henry songs that were in mind, and I called, he just when I was about to call him, he called me, so kismet.
So you choose a producer based on the fact that you think that that person will understand what you're trying to do, or will bring in new ideas?
It's a partnership, really, because I'm pretty well, I know what kind of music I want to do, and I pick the songs. So it's mostly if they have a bunch of musicians or an engineer that I really like the sonic sound of what they're getting and the taste, and it's all about chemistry and getting the right people in the room. So.
Had you ever worked with Bill Frisell before? How did
I did? I hadn't worked
with
him.
He's a jazz guitarist.
Oh, but he's so eclectic, and we had run into each other here in New York, and mutual fans, and we said we hoped to work together. And of course, he played on Joe's records too. So that was one we built our schedule of when I would get in the studio when he was free.
Also, jazz musicians are different today. They grew up with rock music, so they understand that tradition as well as what they do.
Yeah, and in Bill's case, he's as eclectic as they come. I mean, he gets just as likely to remind you of Hendrix as he is, you know, Django Reinhardt.
Well, you're also eclectic in your choice of material. How do you decide what you want to put on a CD? I'm afraid to say an album these days.
I still call them albums.
On Slipstream, you have a couple of Bob Dylan songs from 15 years ago, a Jerry Rafferty Top 40 hit that's over 30 years old, and then some of your own.
Yeah, well, there's a song that I contributed the lyrics to with my guitarist doing the music. But the other ones are, you know, everybody from Ireland's Paul Brady, who I've recorded songs of before, and Randall Bramlett as well. It's really just a matter of building like a good concert set. It's a really good pacing. You have to get the right mixture of lyrical and musical freshness so that for your fans after 19 records, you know, I pretty much set a lot of those ideas. You want to come up with something new. So it you put it together like a great meal, like a great evening. You know, there's got to be pacing with enough, not too many ballads in a row. And now you've been here for a while, so let's go there. So after all these years and records, I've kind of, that's one of the fun parts about my job.
And one of the debates is always, what do we start it with?
Oh, yeah.
Because that sets the tone for everything else.
But it's usually pretty undeniable what you want to start with.
Well, we just played the track that you started with, because what are you trying to tell listeners with that track?
Well, I don't know, but my...
Million Miles.
Well, the... Oh, no, we played Used to Rule the World.
Used to Rule the World.
Well, it's a nice little wink to the age that we're in, and that I mean that as a country and also as a, you know, literally as you get older and you can't find your car and all these people who thought they had it together and Match.com and they're in the bathroom looking for a back way out because the guy's a dud. You know, it was a clever and interesting way to take a look at that. And musically, you know, you can't go wrong with James Brown and that kind of funk, that R&B. I pick my tunes according to what I want to play live, and that's a groove that I love to play.
Now, you co-wrote a song with Al Anderson, who used to be with the cult rock group NRBQ.
Actually, we did three of his songs, but I didn't co-write with him. Bonnie Bramlett is on one co-write, and Bonnie Bishop is on another. And me, I'm on the one with George Martinelli. So, but I love NRBQ.
I was wondering what happened to Bonnie Bramlett. She was a big star in
the
60s or 70s and then disappeared?
Yeah, she was on Roseanne as an actress for a while, and her daughter is very well respected in the Nashville R&B singing scene as well. But I think Bonnie occasionally sings. She still sounds fantastic.
On the hits package that you put out together with the old album, this one called Now and Then, there's also, the real title is Something to Talk About? One of your biggest hits?
Yeah, I mean, this was a collection that Starbucks approached us right before Slipstream came out, and they said, you know, we do these Opus series where we go back in people's back catalog and pull out some of the songs that weren't hits, that are sort of the unrecognized gems, we feel. And I said, hey, wow me, you know, I'm all for it if you can impress me with a list. And they came back with a pretty inventive one, and you know, it, of course, included Something to Talk About and some of the Nick of Time and things that people would know, and they're not crazy. So it was a good title, Something to Talk About.
But you obviously listen to other people's music rather carefully because sometimes you find these little treasures from a group like Little Feet.
Yeah, or NRBQ, like you said. Yeah.
I remember hearing that you once said you missed Lowell George from Little Feet each day, and that his music made you happy like no one else's.
Well, yeah, I said I miss Little Feet more than I miss being 8 years old, like the way I miss being 8 years old. There was a certain carefree time, and it's also associated because Lowell was alive when we were all in our 20s. And there's still, you know, Little Feet still is a default for me. Go when I really want to change my mood. There's certain people like Bruce Hornsby and Little Feet, vintage especially for Little Feet, that just knocks me out, and to this day it'll change my mood.
I'm speaking with none other than Bonnie Raitt, who has a lot of things going on these days. I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but what slide guitarist made an impression on you when you were starting out?
You know, I was growing up in L.A., and I couldn't, you know, I was too young to go to the folk clubs. Ash Grove was a good scene there, but I didn't have a way to get there. You know, I was 14 or whatever. So I was a stone folky from going to summer camp, and everybody in the country was playing guitar. It seemed like all the counselors.
So but I'm, bottleneck? Only
oh, but
a few
I
women
get.
Play
but I had learned to play like Joan Baez and play all those folk music records that I got for Christmas and Bob Dylan. But then I heard blues at Newport 63 on Vanguard, and John Hammond was the first time I'd ever heard bottleneck guitar, and I'd never seen photographs. There wasn't YouTube. I was just a kid out in L.A., so I soaked the label off a Coracetin pill bottle, put it on what I thought was maybe what they were talking about, because my grandpa had played Hawaiian lap steel hymns, so I knew if I tuned to open tuning, I could just figure it out. So by the time I actually saw Sun House and listened to Robert Johnson's records and Mississippi Fred McDowell, three of whom were big influences, and got to see John Hammond, I realized I had actually put it on the wrong finger, and what they were using were actual bottlenecks from wine bottles, which is what I use now.
Sometimes they also use a piece of metal.
Absolutely, yeah.
I was surprised to hear that your grandfather played guitar, because I've always thought of you as coming from, a pretty musical family of another sort. Your father, John Raitt, was a big Broadway musical star, also in mm-hmm. movies, and your mother, Marjorie, was a pianist.
His musical director and pianist, yeah. But her dad was a Methodist missionary and minister in Southern California, and he wrote hundreds of pop songs and hymns. And my mom played organ and piano in the church, but he taught me hymns on a Hawaiian lap steel when I was 5 and 6 years old. And then I remember thinking how easy it was to play the guitar, because you don't have to learn the chords. You can just pull the bar across it, and there you are. You're singing Jesus Loves Me, Yes, I Know.
How do you know whether a song is appropriate for bottleneck or not?
Oh, you know, it's like...
Does it just have to be a blues?
You know, it's one of those instruments that's so like a human voice. You can add it on anything. I mean, it's pretty clear when it doesn't fit, but it's very evocative. It can be raunchy and fierce like Elmore James. It can be soulful like Lowell George, or, you know, when you play on a ballad, when Ry Cooter is the master that's ever of all time on the slide guitar, and Lowell's right behind him. Of the Delta bluesmen, Mississippi Fred McDowell and Sun House and John Hammond were big influences me.
Well, sometimes the surprise helps. I remember a great record by the Ward Singers where they had pedal steel guitar on a gospel album.
Sacred Steel is a huge... I just saw Maria Muldaur play with the Campbell Brothers, and that's three brothers that play all electric slide and lap steel. Unbelievably exciting. If you haven't heard it, guys, go out and get the Campbell Brothers' new record. It's killer.
Well, I assume that your father never had to learn to play an instrument because he always was accompanied by a great orchestra.
He was, but he did love to play the trumpet, and he actually composed on the piano. He was a pretty
played
good
the trumpet?
Yeah, when he was a kid. He did reveille at his father ran a YMCA camp. He woke everybody up every day.
Did he like the business side of music business?
I don't think he did that as well. I learned from him because he wasn't involved. I vowed to be very much involved, which I probably spend more time running my business with my staff than I do thinking about songwriting.
Was he encouraging about you going into music?
I don't think either of my parents were too thrilled when I took a leave of absence my sophomore year at Harvard. I said, I'll be back, but these older blues guys that I've had the great privilege of meeting through another friend of mine who managed them, I said, these guys aren't going to be around forever, and this is my passion, and I would like to travel around, and I'll come back. And I did come back, but then I got offered a record deal sort of within the time of what would have been my junior year.
Had they expected you to do show tunes?
No. They knew I loved folk music. And they were a little bit, they came to my club in Philadelphia, one of my first gigs, and I was singing Under My Thumb, Turned Around, of course, with the female lyrics saying to a guy. And then I sang Howlin' Wolf, Willie Dixon's song, I'm Built for Comfort, Not for Speed, which, you know, they weren't thrilled to see their 19-year-old singing double entendre songs, but they got over it pretty soon.
What were you majoring at Radcliffe?
I majored in social relations and African studies. I mean, Radcliffe doesn't have classes, so you attend Harvard, and their African studies department was brand new, and they knew I think they were really excited to have new people that were actually already... I wanted to work for the American Friends Service Committee and probably go to Tanzania, but by my junior year, Nereri said, we don't want any more well-meaning college kids from America. Closed the program, and there you go. I started my career.
Well, also, it's nice when your career takes off and you don't have to apologize for quitting that school.
Yeah, no, they knew I could come back at any time, but I wasn't expecting to do as well as I did.
Let's take a little break. We will go into the break with your recording of a song by Bob Dylan, Million Miles. This is from Slipstream.
featuring Bill Frisell on that beautiful guitar.
And my guest is Bonnie Raitt, who won her 10th Grammy last year for the CD Slipstream. It is now combined with her first career-spanning retrospective in a two-disc package called Now and Then from Red Wing Records, which is your label.
Yeah, very proud.
Took a part of me that I really miss. I keep asking myself, how long can it go on like this? You told yourself a lie. That's all right, I told myself one too. Well, I try to get closer, but I'm still a million miles. Silver and you took the gold. You left me standing out in the cold. People ask about you. I didn't tell them everything I knew. Well, I try to get closer, but I'm still a million miles from you.
Back with my conversation with Bonnie Raitt from November. This song was one of her biggest hits, and it's included in her new release of older recordings called Now and Then, which has been packaged with her 2012 album, Slipstream. When it came on, she commented that it sounded so slow, so I asked her, when you sing it in concerts, do you usually sing it a little faster?
When you're playing in front of an audience, and you're, you know, it's not quite the same as sitting in a chair in the studio, and it still sounds like that. It's just funny. I don't listen to my own record, so it has a certain charm to it, but it's sonically very different than when you're playing it.
And why don't you listen to your own records? I know in speaking to jazz musicians, they often tell me that it's hard to listen because they hear the missed opportunities.
Oh yeah, well. I mean, when you're making it, I mix it, and I'm doing the overdubs on it and basically involved with all the production and stuff. So once it's out, I'm back on the road doing them live. So it's kind of fun because when you're doing promotion, somebody will play this like this. But, you know, I don't like to listen back. I like to sing.
Well, how different does it become when you're singing it live in a concert?
Well, it's just in the moment. You know, the song's alive. You know, you're in that 3 minutes, whether it's a sad song or a rocker or a sexy kind of a bluesy thing, you're just in that, you're in that great song. That's why it's really important to pick great songs.
Now, you took a break before you recorded Slipstream for a year, and that was the first break you took since the mid-90s. But it wasn't exactly a vacation, was it?
No, I actually decided after a series of long illnesses and passing of the close members of my family, my mom in 2004, my dad in 2005, and all during the decade my older brother was fighting brain cancer. He miraculously lived 7 years on a macrobiotic diet, but eventually got another tumor and passed away in 2009. And another friend of mine also lost his battle. So I just was really brokenhearted and had to keep touring and making records during that decade. And once we finished the Taj Mahal tour after my brother passed away, we did a wonderful national tour with one of my heroes and dear friends, Taj, which was very healing and cathartic. I said, I'm getting off this treadmill and not thinking about my next project.
And so were you able to just allow things to, was it kind of like filling up the dam?
Well, a lot of, I deliberately wanted to do some grief work because if you have to be high functioning during going through all that crisis, you learn how to push it down kind of. And if you don't really let all those emotions come out, and most people don't have the luxury of taking a sabbatical like that. And I consciously wanted to work with somebody that does grief therapy, and it was very transformative because I went back in my childhood and did a bunch of stuff when you're on the road you don't have a chance to do.
But then during your break, you also heard your song, I Can't Make You Love Me, recorded by both Bon Iver and Adele. And Adele said, I think it's just perfect in every single way. And then talking about you, she said, she's got a stunning voice.
That's
so
sweet.
Adele is one of your fans.
Yeah, I'm very, very honored that so many people, especially on these TV shows like The Voice and American Idol, they pick both Something to Talk About and I Can't Make You Love Me numerous times to showcase. And so it's brought a lot of younger fans into, I think Adele especially has brought a lot of younger fans to my concerts even.
Perhaps they like that song because it's got a real melody, and there are so many songs that have almost anonymous melodies these days.
Yeah, it's the power. That's one of the reasons I'm so pleased that Adele's doing so well, because she's a fine songwriter as well as a great soul singer.
But when you're writing a song in a time when often songs just sound like a minor blues riff or not even that, are you still trying to do the kind of classic thing, the thing that we associate with the Great American Songbook, a melody that people might want it to be singing 20 or 30 years from now?
Well, I haven't written. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time on the last decade writing, and I probably will again, but I pick songs that have great melodies because I'm from a time, especially growing up as my dad's daughter, you know, with a classic golden era of Rodgers and Hammerstein and listening to some of the greatest pop music ever written. I grew up really appreciating a great melody, and You Can't Fail Me Now, and the Paul Brady songs that I've recorded, like Not the Only One, are some of the most beautiful melodies. And that's one of the reasons I picked those songs, is because they're so melodically classic. And I'm a product of my era, but I'm also listening to a lot of great jazz as well.
Did you sing much with your father?
I did get to sing with him. And after I turned 40, John Williams called, not because of that, but when Nick of Time came out, John Williams called my dad and I both to come and perform together at the Boston Pops for a PBS show, and that's when I sang Hey There for the first time, and he sang one of my songs with me, and then we went off and running and we did a 3-song set with a live orchestra for his Broadway Legend album, which was nominated for a Grammy in the mid-90s, and then he played Radio City and on tour with me along with John Lee Hooker. He was my special guest.
Oh my.
And so I did They Say That Falling in Love Is Wonderful. We did I Can Do Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better from Annie Get Your Gun, and we did Hey There from Pajama Game. Thrilling for me.
And John Lee Hooker sang Black Snake Moan.
And then my dad and him were over in the corner, Natalie dressed with their legs crossed, talking about arthritis and Viagra. And then after my dad came out, then John Lee would come out and do a duet with me. So who else alive today gets to have those two guys on the same stage?
Incredible. Bonnie Raitt is with me. She won her 10th Grammy last year for Slipstream. And now she's combined that with her first retrospective album, a two-disc package called Now and Then from her own label, Red Wing Records. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you feel that there is an artistic gene in families? Since you grew up with music, could you really have considered doing much else?
Well, I was very much interested in working for the American Friends Service Committee and being a social activist, which, thank God, I get to do with my music as much as I would have, if not more, had more impact. Certainly raised more money and attention for my causes.
Is that because your parents were Quakers?
Uh-huh, yeah. I'm very much so. I mean, we were involved with the band, the bomb marches. I went to the same nuclear band march in 1964 in Washington, and civil rights was a big part of my era, and of course folk music and political activism went hand in hand when I came up.
And that still is true. Your tour bus is powered by biodiesel, and your album packages use recycled materials. They're printed in soy ink.
Yeah, we do what we can, you know, to try to lessen our footprint. And I got 22 people on the road, and we're in hotels every night, so we try to be conscious about which ones we pick so that we don't waste a lot of water. We ban plastic as much as possible on the road.
And what about your guitar? Isn't that also made of recycled materials?
I've got one guitar that's made out of recycled aircraft aluminum and salvaged wood. And, you know, the rest of them are so old they could be considered upuse.
What did your brother Steve do? Was he also in music?
He was a sound mixer and a sometimes singer and a great record producer and worked in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
Many singers' voices seem to show wear and tear with time. Do you have a special secret formula for keeping yours in such great shape?
Well, thank you, Leonard, first of all. These days I warm up, and I usually have to, in order to make the sounds that really warm up your voice in a quick way, you don't want to be around other people, like in a hotel room or the dressing room. The guys, I can hear them laughing at me. So I try to warm up when we travel with bicycles in the bay of the bus, and we ride at night so that we can have some time in the day. And when I ride my bike off into the parking lot, and then I warm up.
You don't want other people to hear you warming up because I used to know a very famous singer who was also considered pretty much an egomaniac, and the members of her band always laugh when she sang me, 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 me.
Oh, that's pretty, Leonard. Yeah, there's some vocalizing that you can do that you need soundproof. When you're in a hotel, you don't want to disturb the people next to you.
You're about to go on a major tour. Do you, unlike so many other performers, enjoy going on the road?
I do, and actually this last 40-date swing through the States is the end of a two-year. We did 95 dates in the States last year, including two sold-out shows here at the Beacon, and now we're going to be playing the hinterlands around New York, Westbury, Porchester, the beautiful new Capitol Theater, the New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark, and, you know, we're hitting the cities that we didn't hit last time. And I love touring as much as my dad did, and he played until he was in his mid-80s.
And do you get to see the places that you're visiting, that you're performing in? Because that's often been a complaint to musicians. Well, there I was in Paris, but we did the concert, and we moved on to Berlin.
Well, that's why we drive at night. As much as possible, we leave after the gig, after the after show. And we wake up in another city, five cities a week. And then, you know, there's cities, bikes to rent here in New York. You know, the buses can't park, really. It's too expensive and to take up that much parking. So we are on our own in the city. But thanks to these bike ride places all over Europe now, that's the best way to see the city if it's not pouring rain or snowing.
We're going to play Ain't Gonna Let You Go, where you play Bottleneck.
Yes, I do, and it's an Al Anderson song from one of my favorite bands. He's a great songwriter, not with that group anymore, but NRBQ, one of the greatest.
National Rhythm and Blues Quartet.
Yeah, New Rhythm and Blues Quartet.
Was it new?
And Terry Adams has continued to go, and Joey Spampinato's got his own brothers group, and they're both going strong.
And this is one of the tracks on your new album, Now and Then.
Co-written by the great Bonnie Bramlett and Al Anderson together.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Bonnie Raitt.
Thank you, Leonard. It's an honor to be in this legendary seat.
like I'm somebody else, but baby, that's all right. You're not the man I was looking for. You're every bit of him, plus a whole lot more. Now that I got you, I feel so good. Don't wanna let you go. I plead guilty, baby, to this terrible crime. You've been loving me all of this time, and I must have been blind. Yeah.